Okay, the power of silence in today's world. Because a lot of people, like myself, we talk a lot. Sometimes people ask me, at your age, are you doing exercises, Ajahn Brahm? And I do many exercises with my mouth. My mouth is very strong. And I confirm something I've noticed watching other people go, oh, get old. As you get older, sometimes your eyes get very weak. Sometimes you get hard of hearing. Sometimes your hands aren't strong and your legs are weak. As you get older, many parts of your body get weaker and weaker and weaker, except one thing, which always gets stronger with age, and that is your mouth. Old people really don't have to talk. But the power of silence is important for our spiritual and well-being, for our physical health, and also for our wisdom and compassion. And unfortunately, in today's world, it's so hard to find silence. When I was still a layperson living in London, you know, it was such a busy city. And sometimes, you know, you'd be shopping for something, you know, as a layperson, not as a monk. I don't know how to shop these days as a monk. You know, you go past the shops over there. I could never see a shop selling monk's robes, dresses, suits. There's no monk's robe shop, so it's a waste of time me going shopping. What I really am surprised about, because I do go travelling a lot, you go to Singapore, you go to Malaysia, it's amazing. People from Melbourne go to Singapore to shop. And people from Singapore come to Melbourne to shop. I mean, there's something going wrong with it somewhere. But monks don't shop anywhere. But when you were a layperson doing your business, sometimes you got really tired. And I used to try and find like one of the great cathedrals or churches over in London. The doors were always open. You could go in there and sit and just be quiet for a few minutes. And that would always give me a sense of peace. Now, you weren't a Christian, I was a Buddhist, but I just liked the silence of those huge buildings. And I remember the last time I went into one of those big buildings was into Westminster Abbey in London. This huge cathedral, this vast cavernous space. And as soon as I walked in, just to have a bit of silence, to rest my mind and my body, I was so disappointed. And in fact, I was really upset because since the time I previously visited, the organization running that cathedral had installed a PA system. And they were running announcements, sermons, chanting, and there was no silence anymore. And I thought, you've just desecrated a beautiful place of silence by all these words. I didn't need those words. You don't need the explanations. All you need is an opportunity for quietness. And examples of that. There is the place where I live in Perth. That monastery where I live is very, very quiet. In fact, Australia is a great place for monasteries. Where you go to Sri Lanka or Thailand or even Vietnam, the forest is always really noisy. All the cicadas and other animals which come out at night when you want a bit of peace and quiet. But in Australia, the only animals which come out at night are the kangaroos. Just bum, bum, bum. That's all they do. It's very quiet. And I know that many people, many monks and nuns have come from overseas and say, what a wonderful place these Australian monasteries are. They're more silent than probably any other place in the world. That's a wonderful gift. The vast spaces, just a little way out of the city, you can find silence. And there's something so beautiful and sacred in that. And so, after one day, this man came to see me. And he was our local building inspector. The fellow in the local council has to approve your building licenses. And he came to say thank you to me. I said, I thought we should say thank you to you for approving all our buildings. He said, no, no. He said, I'm about to retire. Today is my last day. You don't know this, But every time I got stressed out at work, every time I had problems I couldn't solve, I would get into my car. I'd drive to your car park in the monastery and just park there and just drink in the silence of your monastery. And that's all I needed. Half an hour later, I'd go back to work, relieved, de-stress, able to face all the problems of my work. And he came to thank me for having a car park in our monastery. So remember the importance of the car park in the monastery you built. It was just because it was silent and peaceful. You didn't need people to talk to you or tell you anything. You just needed a place of quietness. And that ability to find a quiet place is so, so, so important. And the other story which someone told me was in Bangkok. They went to visit a temple, this Australian guy. And when he went into the entrance, he was going into the hall to meet somebody. And outside of the hall, he saw a woman on a bench, crying her eyes out, sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And he thought, first of all, out of kindness, to go and talk to the poor girl. Maybe he could help. But because he was Australian and she was Thai, he didn't know whether he could understand the language. Number two, he didn't know whether it was culturally appropriate to help her without her being asked. So, sometimes you don't feel all that comfortable in different cultures. So he went into the hall anyway, did whatever he did. And as he was walking out, he saw the woman there, and she was wiping her eyes. She wasn't sort of weeping so much. And so he thought, no, I will ask her if she's okay. And so he went up to her and asked, are you okay? Is anything wrong? She said, I'm okay now. What was the problem? She said, I lost my car keys. But all I did, and I was crying my eyes out, I couldn't find my car keys. He said, now I feel okay. Now I'm going to go and sort of call my husband to go a spare set of keys. And all she needed, now in a small little disappointment like that, she didn't need counselling, she didn't need to get advice from a person. All she needed to do was have a quiet place she could sit down, rest and relax, and allow the sort of the sadness to disappear by itself. Silence is one of the greatest of healers. And sometimes all we need is a place to be quiet. And because of that, I've known many, many friends who've been very innovative of finding a quiet place where they can just sit. One person was a lawyer in New York City. And this was quite a long time ago. The time when New York State had the death penalty for people who committed sort of crimes like murder or rape. And this was a lawyer who had to defend people accused of murder. If you made a mistake, then the person would be sent to electric chair or what they don't have they executed in New York. It reminds me of another story about just how people use spin in today's world. It's actually told me by one of the past Governor Generals who gave a speech which I listened to. And he said there was a family, a quite a wealthy family in the United States, who commissioned an author to do a biography of their family. And they told the author, you have to be honest, it had to be an accurate history, but not too demeaning or criticizing the family. And they said there was one problem. They did have one of their members of the family who committed a crime, and he was executed on the electric chair in Sing Sing. And they said, I don't know how you're going to do this, but be accurate. But don't criticize our family for this one person. And so the author, being very smart, he could do well on the Melbourne Age, wrote, and this particular member of the family unexpectedly died at a young age. He got a chair in a famous state institution, and his death came as a shock to everybody. He was executed with a chair. But anyway, back to silence. Is when we can have a little bit of silence in our life, it's amazing just how therapeutic it can be. And this one lawyer, he wanted to have a place where he'd be silent enough just to rest. And he was a lawyer in a big office. Telephones coming. In those days, fax machines. And everything tried to make him disturbed. So what he did, there was a cupboard in his office full of papers. You've always got cupboards somewhere. Together with his secretary, they took out all of those papers. They stored them somewhere else. And that became his meditation cupboard. Every lunchtime, his secretary would lock him in his cupboard for half an hour. What a wonderful idea that would be, to have a cupboard for your boss at work, so you can lock them away for half an hour. Even better, maybe your husband or your wife at home, lock them in the cupboard, have a bit of peace and stillness for a little while. So, he would do that every lunch hour. And it meant when he had some stillness, he could rest, had some silence. He became a much better lawyer in the afternoon. Now, for his own emotional benefit, but certainly saving a lot of lives from the electric chair. And his secretary loved locking him in his cupboard simply because he wasn't a pain in the arse, you know, during that time. It could be a bit more peaceful. And often, you know, she would say, someone would call and they'd visit, we want to see this guy. And I'd say, I'm sorry, sir, he's in his cupboard. So what a wonderful thing to do in life. You have many cupboards. It's just a place of silence where you can rest and relax and be peaceful. So a lot of times, just being silent helps calm your body and calm your mind so you're healthier. But also, it makes you wiser as well. Because often, we have the idea, the more we think about our problems, the more likely we'll find solutions. And so as human beings, we become obsessed with thinking. And when the problem gets really big, we think even more. And sometimes we think so much we can't sleep at night. And what good is that to anybody? There's always, you've always heard this before, you know, the wisdom born of silence. Because when you stop thinking and you're silent, it's amazing how many ideas come up to the surface. You all know that when you try and remember somebody's name and you can't. I have that problem a lot. I visit so many Buddhist groups and non-Buddhist groups, and people come up to me and say, do you remember me? I saw you 5 years ago. Come on, give me a break. But I found the perfect answer, please, you can use this as well. You don't want to upset anybody when they say, do you remember me? You say no. So what you do is, the perfect answer is, they come up to me and say, do you remember me? And I say, yes, of course I remember you. You're the person whose name I keep forgetting. And number one, that's being honest. And number two, you know, it's not making them feel so rejected or sort of, they're not special. So, if you try to remember a name, and of course you all know, you think, and you can't remember it. When you're silent, the name just pops up. You understand, you see. Because what actually happens is the brain actually does process the information. But we interfere, we give it this white noise, this static, so the information can't be heard. So all you really need to do is program in the problem and then be silent. It's amazing what answers come out. There was one of my disciples, she was a senior social worker in Western Australia. And she was one of these people who had to deal with problems like, should we take the children away from the parents because the parents may be drug addicts? You know, should we try and get a visit from the person in prison so that the rest of the family, you know, who are maybe dying of cancer, so they can actually see them? Really difficult social problems whose answers are just so hard to find. You know, whichever way you go, it seems to be causing problems. So doing nothing is even a worse problem. And she had all this stress and responsibility of making decisions which would strongly affect people's families and lives. And so when I was holding a retreat, a meditation retreat, She booked in, but she came really late, about 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night, because she was in the office trying to tie up all the loose ends, trying to fix things up. When it comes about 11, 11:30, you know, it was too late, she's not going to fix things up, so she just left everything undone and just came to our retreat center. You know what it's like, there's so much work to do, you try to finish it off, but you just can't. She just left it. And when she came to the retreat, she was wise enough to remember, stop thinking about those things. Leave them alone, let them go, relax. And after 3 or 4 days, she came to see me. She was just meditating, just relaxing. And just out of the blue, so she said, all these answers came to her. And these were so innovative, so brilliant, they're out-of-the-box answers. And she simply wrote them down and said, this is what I'm going to do when I go back to work. She wasn't forcing the issue. She wasn't thinking hard. She just programmed it into her mind before she came. Relaxed, let go, was silent. And then the answers came. So many of us waste so much opportunity. We try to force the answers by thinking them through, and they never work. You don't come out that way. That's not the way you solve problems in life. It's not even the way you make decisions in life. I said at the university, you know, yesterday, that one person, when I was teaching in Oslo University a couple of years ago, and the question time, they asked this of me. They say, I have an important decision to make in life. How do you make decisions? Because it's a decision which will radically affect my life either way. And how can I make a good decision? And I told her, number one, please don't think about it. Because an important decision in life, you think about it and it drives you crazy. You just cannot find the answer. So there was another method, I told her. But first of all, I said, let's ground this in something practical. And I said to her, suppose the decision was, should I marry my boyfriend or not? And at that point, she went bright red. She held her hand over her mouth, and she looked at her boyfriend sitting next to her. That's what she was thinking. Be very careful of asking monks such questions. Nailed her in one. So she's really embarrassed, because that was the very question she was contemplating. This boy sitting next to her, they'd obviously had a long relationship, you know, should we go to the next level and get married or not? Should we commit? And you know just how that would affect your life. So I told her, look, if you want to make a decision like that, and you may have decisions like that you have to make from time to time, should I change my job? You know, I've got this, doctor says maybe I should take an operation, maybe not. Really difficult decisions you have to make in life. What should you do? And the answer is, get out a coin and toss a coin. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. But it's much more nuanced than that. Because what do you do? You make that sort of heads I marry him, tails I don't. Heads I leave my job, tails I stay there. Or whatever else. Heads I have the operation, tails I don't. But when you toss that coin, after it comes up, notice your reaction. So heads I marry him, and it comes up heads. What is your reaction? Do you think, 2 out of 3. That means you don't want to marry him. And if it comes up head, yes, that means you do. Tossing the coin is not to make a decision for you, but to discover what you really want to do. And what you really want to do is actually tying into that intuition inside of you, that inner feeling of what is right, what is wrong, what's going to work, what's not going to work. And that is always more accurate than thinking. Psychology study after psychology study has proved when you feel what the right answer is, you're allowed to get a higher correct score than when you think it through. Which is why people are crazy. They make so many mistakes because they think too much and they feel too little. Silence is another way of getting into touch with those physical feelings. You feel what you need to do, and it comes quite obvious to you. And if you can't do that, toss the coin. So, you know, buy one of those paintings in the back. Heads are by that painting, tails are by the other painting. Not heads, I think, tails are that. So, that silence is where you get a lot of wisdom from. Which is why if you do have a problem, a big problem you have to solve, please don't force the issue. It's like that other way of using silence to influence other people. Now, as Buddhists, we are great psychologists. Especially when you've been meditating for such a long time. I've been telling everybody the last couple of days that last November I was in Toronto and got an invitation to give a lecture as part of the course on Buddhism, psychology and medicine. And the head of that sort of course unit, which is part of the degree course in the social sciences, part of that degree course is actually moving to McGill University next semester. McGill is the top university in Toronto. He said, and then it's going moving south over the border in the United States. Now, I don't know if Monash has got this, but it damn well should do. Now, to have Buddhism, medicine and psychology, because this is happening. Buddhism has got the goods on psychology, and people are now using that for the happiness and health of human beings. So, psychology is very strong, and I'll give you an example of that. Because, as many of you know, the first spiritual advisor of the Buddhist Society of Victoria was Ajahn Jagua, and he was my boss in the monastery where I was living. And when you have a boss, that may be your husband, or normally your wife, or a boss at work, sometimes it's very hard to influence them. Now, especially in Buddhist monastery, because the more older you are, the more senior, the more authority you have. And especially, many of you remember Ajahn Jagua. You know, when he wanted something, he got it. So I had to use my psychology to get my own way. And this is the example of how to get your husband to follow your every wish. I would actually, because we were building our monastery, and we needed more huts, and I was a builder. So, I would say to him, and this is real, this happened. I said, why don't we build a hut over there on that sort of hilltop? And he would say, no, that's a ridiculous idea. Don't be stupid. No. Now comes the silence. You don't push it. You don't repeat it. You have programmed the information into his head. So I forgot. I said, okay. And I wouldn't speak about it again for another couple of weeks. Another couple of weeks had gone. He'd forgotten the conversation completely. And I'd reinforce it. I'd be walking with him and said, why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? He said, no, don't be ridiculous. A stupid idea. You don't argue. Okay, I said. Usually that's all I need, just two inputs, at most three. And you wouldn't believe just how well this worked. Be walking with him a couple of weeks later, and he'd turn around to me and said, I just had an idea. Why don't we build a hut on the hill? And the icing, you must always remember this, you say, wow, what a brilliant idea of yours. He fell for it every time. That's how I influenced him and got my own way, even though I was a boss. So you try that with your husband. And you say, darling, I need a new dress. You've got enough dresses. You can't afford it. Oh, you're right. It's got him. Okay, don't argue. Don't be stupid. Follow with silence. Don't pout. Don't stop giving him any dinner. Wait for a couple of weeks. And then say it again. Darling, you know, I really need a new dress. Oh, no, no, we can't afford it. You know, you've got enough. And it's amazing how well this works. You know, you'd be at dinner one day and say, darling, I think you need a new dress. Oh, that's so kind of you. Just thinking of that all by yourself. Thank you. And that does work, because what happens psychologically, when you say something, it always goes into the brain, it is remembered. And if it is a good idea, which is obviously a good idea, you do need a new dress. You can't have too many dresses, can you? But it is a good idea. So it just works its way through the brain of your husband or the brain of your boss. If it's a good idea, it will have traction, and he will think it's his idea. And that's the most important thing. The boss, the person you're trying to sort of know, who's got the bank card, that they know is your idea. I don't know if you know about that man who gave his wife plastic surgery. So kind. He gave his wife plastic surgery. He cut up all her plastic credit cards. He called her plastic surgery. She was spending too much. But so that is how, you know, you can influence people. Our trouble is, because we make too much noise, that is why. That is why we speak too much, we get caught. That is why it never works. And also, silence is great to be a listener. So often in life, especially, no, relationships, marriages, okay? How many of you think your husband doesn't understand you? How many of you think your wife doesn't listen? I remember this one man, he told me, he said, I've been married for 20 years. It took me 15 years of practice to be able to listen to my wife without hearing her. So just pretending to listen. And that's terrible, isn't it? Why is it that, you know, we have such a hard time communicating with each other? Now, many times people ask me questions. They, you know, they want to sort of communicate with the monk and try and get the wisdom out of you. So how do you do that? Because sometimes you're not very articulate the way you ask questions. Sometimes you're scared of asking the question because there may be personal matters you don't really want to share. And so a lot of times when people are talking to me, I use the practice called total silence. I don't even think in my head. You make not just not talking with your mouth, but not thinking inside either. Because I want to receive as much information and data as possible. And sometimes when you're silent, when you're thinking inside, it does mean you're absorbing everything. Not just the words, but the tone of the language. The spaces even between the words, the body language, even the smells you can pick up. Because when you're silent, you're sensitive. Half of your brain is not taken up with noticing your thinking. Everything is available just for getting communication from the person in front of you. And that makes you very sensitive. You can pick up so much from the other person. And that is why you can actually give answers which are quite surprising. Because it's not just what they said, it's just the way they said it. And their body language as they were speaking. It's not something you think about, it's just something which happens when you're very silent. If you have a sponge which is already damp, it can't mop up much of the water spilled on the table. But if the sponge is perfectly dry, it can mop up so much, it can absorb so much. So when your mind is silent, it is like a dry sponge. It can absorb so much. And that is often where wisdom comes from. And sometimes people accuse me of reading their minds. I don't read their minds, it's being sensitive, picking up, because you're silent, and seeing what comes out afterwards. And that silence is incredibly powerful sometimes. I like to repeat this little anecdote, because often, you know, you get cases, they're brought to a monk or to a nun, which ordinary psychologists or therapists can't deal with. Now we're almost like people of last resort. No one else, nothing else works, so they come to us. And so we get some very tough cases. And I remember once in Kuala Lumpur, they asked me, can you please spend 15 minutes just to counsel this woman? No one else has been able to help her. And first of all, I never asked what the problem is, because then I start thinking about it. So it says, certainly. So this woman came in, maybe about 35 or 40, hadn't got a clue what her problem was, only that every other counselor psychologist had tried and failed. So what I did, when she came in, perfect silence inside, no thinking, and let her speak, and feel her. You have this mind which can absorb all of the information. And as she spoke, with me being silent inside, she recounted in terrible detail how she'd been brutally raped. Terrible thing to happen to a woman. And I was silent throughout, not judging, not reacting, just absorbing. And when she finished, these words came out of my mouth, which shocked me. These were not premeditated, they weren't thought, it just came out. I said to her, you're so lucky to have been raped. It shocked me, what I said, and her jaw dropped as well. And I realized what I'd said, and what I meant from that silence. This is not something you can do by thinking or planning. It really is coming out of the box. How on earth can you say to a woman who's gone through such torture and then left these wounds which were gaping and painful, how can anyone say you're so lucky to have been raped? And then I told her what I meant. I said, somehow or other, I felt that you have the strength, the spiritual power to actually to walk free from what happened to you. I could never understand what you went through. But when you walk out of that terrible ordeal and become free, the reason I said you're lucky, because I know you will walk out of this, because you'll be able to do something I will never ever be able to do. You'll be able to put your arm around someone who's been raped like you have, and to tell them, I know. I know what you're feeling. I've been there. But you'll also be able to tell them something which was so valuable, so precious. You'll also be able to say, I know the way out. Hold my hand, come with me. I'll take you to the place where you can be free of this. So that's why you're lucky. This is a reason for you to help so many other people. Something I can never do. When I said that, again, it was totally coming from a place of silence. She had jaw dropped, she smiled. She went off, found her way out, and counseled others who had been raped. She found the meaning of that, how to turn it around for her and other people's immense benefit. Other people, other counselors, you think you can't say such things. And it would only work for her, it wouldn't work for other people. You can't just have a one-size-fits-all, which is what, sometimes what we do. One of my favourite sayings is, never ever allow your knowledge, your learning, to stand in the way of truth. All those thoughts, that's just your learning, what the books say, what you've heard. To really see truth, you've got to suspend all that. Put it aside. And just be silent. And then you respond in such innovative ways. That worked for that lady. That's why I say, if it didn't work, I'd be in trouble. And I wouldn't repeat it to you. But for her, it was the right message at the right time. Only can come from silence. Another case, this was from one of the Australian spiritual leaders. What's the name? She's in Sydney, close to London. I forget. They haven't come to me after a little while. She's quite a famous little psychologist. She came very close to cancer, got through it. Got through it. And now spends time counselling others. And she mentioned in the talk, I went to a conference and she was also presenting at the conference. And I listened to her say that one occasion there was a wealthy woman from San Francisco who made an appointment for counseling with her, came all the way from San Francisco to Sydney to see her. And again, she was a last resort, been to all the best psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists in California. And my goodness, there's a lot of therapists and psychologists in California. That's a home of therapy. But anyway, nothing worked, so she came to this lady in Sydney. And this lady did exactly the same. Knowing that conventional answers would never work, she'd been there, done that, with people far more qualified than she was. So she was silent. As the lady started to tell all of the anxiety disorders, depressions, and cancers which were ravaging her body. And when she finished telling this, this Australian woman, her answer to that was, "You should start playing the violin again." Totally, as they say, out of left field. She didn't know where those words came from, but that's what she said. "Why don't you pick up a violin and start playing it again?" And this wealthy woman from San Francisco burst out crying, weeping, when she came together again. How on earth did you know that? She had come from a wealthy family. She loved playing the violin as a child. But her mother said, "A person of your social status should not do that. Stop it." That was a symbol of her repression growing up in San Francisco. Not being able to do what she loved doing because it was not appropriate for a person of such high class. Not going where she loved to go because ladies are not supposed to go to such places. Being totally repressed all her life, to the point where she had anxiety disorders, depression, and this terrible cancer. And the woman picked it up straight away, through silence. And so she also said, one of the great antidotes to depression, or anxiety, and even to illnesses as well, go and do some social service. Do something for others. Go and play in the hospitals. Or, she said, how about, just out of silence, how about going reading to kids in the burns ward? You know, if you have a serious burn, you have to stay in those sterile wards for weeks sometimes. Because, you know, once you have a burn, the biggest problem is infections. So you have to be in this sterile ward like a prison for weeks and sometimes months before you can come out. And so imagine a kid being in this little prison. What they would want more than anything else is like what prisoners want. Some more sort of stimulation. People from outside, seeing others, not the same old nurses and doctors and fellow patients day in, day out. Go in there and read them some books and stories. And that's what she did. She was only supposed to have about 3 or 4 months to live. She lasted about 4 years. She started a group in California of volunteers visiting the burns wards in hospitals, just reading to people, reading stories, just being with them. Her depression vanished, anxiety went, when she felt she could do what she wanted to do and do something which helped other people. My goodness, that if ever you find anyone who's depressed, one of the great antidotes to that, which actually I see these things myself, but people actually tell me all the scientific research when people have actually found this out. It works. Do some volunteer work. Go and join the committee of the Buddhist Society of Victoria or something, or clean up. If you're in the Monash University, join the Monash University Buddhist group. If you're not, then go to a old people's home and mop the floors, whatever it is. Get out there and help other people. When I was at Cambridge, I had a few Buddhist friends, but most of my friends were Christians. And we had some great sort of discussions and debates and arguments. When you're young, you can have an argument, passionate argument, because they're your friend. The rule was you can argue, you can shout, but whoever won the argument had to pay the next round of drinks. That was the rule. We'd be friends, okay. So I remember one of my friends was a very strong Christian. And he just told in passing that being a good Christian, he was visiting the local mental hospital in Fulbourne in Cambridge to do some social work, volunteer work. And as soon as I heard that, my pride came up. If Christians can do that, so can Buddhists. I want to go too. So I did that. I went just out of pride. They were trying to fly the flag of Buddhists. We're as good as you are, okay? And I went there, and I don't mind saying this, the Christians only lasted 2 weeks. I carried on going there for 2 years. Every Thursday afternoon without fail. Why did I do that? I got so much happiness and joy out of that. It wasn't volunteering anymore. As I looked forward to it, I'd reschedule, you know, appointments with your supervisor or tutors, reschedule it because Thursday afternoon was important for me. And I loved going to that place. You know, I learned so much. I was mostly volunteering with Down syndrome patients. And one of the things which I noticed with those Down syndrome patients, now, if I'd just broken up with my girlfriend, then they would know, they'd know it straight away. And they'd come and give me a big hug. They knew I was down and sad. And I couldn't believe that. First of all, being hugged by another boy in 1970 or something was very difficult for me. I wasn't gay, I was heterosexual. I like hugging girls, not boys. But there you have a little boy hug you. You're down syndrome. And to actually experience that emotional connection. And just to be stunned at how emotionally sensitive those Down syndrome people were. They were much more sensitive, much more intelligent with the emotions than any of the Nobel laureates I knew in Cambridge. And I knew a couple. They were brilliant in chemistry, stupid in life. That's what I used to say. And there I learned the emotional intelligence of a Down syndrome child whose intelligence had never been developed, whose ability to speak, their use of language had never been mastered. But my goodness, they were just so smart in their emotions. They could read me immediately and accurately true too. So not only I learned a lot, I just enjoyed their company. So you never got depressed. You actually enjoyed it. You got an uplift every time you were helping other people. So this lady over in Sydney, brilliant, gave her that advice. Yeah, you couldn't stop the cancers, but you know, delayed it 3 months or 3 or 4 years. It was an amazing achievement. And those 3 or 4 years were high quality life for that San Francisco woman. At last she could play her violin and enjoy what she wanted to do. And also serve others and get so much happiness back. And the little club and society of volunteers does book reading in Children's Hospital, apparently is still there to this day. What a wonderful achievement that was. And that came from her just listening in silence and picking up what needed to be said, what needed to be done. It's a sensitivity which we have, and we can all do that. Imagine if you had that sensitivity to the people you live with. If when your husband came home, just like the Down syndrome, you know straight away when they had a hard day. They know exactly what to do. That emotional intelligence which comes from silence is magnificent. And will make you have a great relationship with the people you love and live with. You feel what's right. Stop thinking. Be silent. Listen to the tone of voice. Not what they say, but how they say it. And listen with your eyes to the body language, how they're standing, how they're looking, and you'll know that straight away. That is actually how you know somebody, through silence. You get incredibly wise that way. And of course, obviously, through that silence, you can actually feel yourself. Don't think about things, feel them. And after a while, yet you can. I have such good awareness these days. That, you know, sometimes people ask me, you know, there's, now obviously, now many of you are my friends, I've known you for such a long time, you care about me, especially you care about my health. Some of you keep on saying I'm putting on too much weight. is actually I'm not putting on weight at all. I looked in the medical directory, and what I suffer from, it has a name, it's called anorexia. Because I looked in the dictionary, and the definition of anorexia is people who look in the mirror and think they're fat. That's me. I look in the mirror and I think I'm fat. It fits perfectly. No. But, okay, you do put on a bit of weight, but I feel very healthy. And sometimes people say, oh, you may be deceiving yourself. No, there is a cause of that. There's a cause of good health. And this came, again, from a scientific paper which somebody sent me. Maybe you're a scientist, so anything interesting and fascinating, they email it to me, or they mail it to me, the latest discoveries in science which are pertinent to me, particularly with meditation or other things. And what the paper they sent me, now, it may make common sense to you, but this was actually proven in sort of laboratory conditions, that when a person is sad, angry, depressed, anxious, your blood vessels contract. They get smaller. But when you're in a good mood, you're happy, you're positive, especially when you're laughing, your blood vessels actually expand. They get bigger. Now, you all know me for a long time. I'm a happy monk. I laugh a lot. I tell jokes. You may not laugh at my jokes, but I certainly laugh at my jokes. And I've laughed so much and so happy for such a long time that the science proves my blood vessels have gone so big, wider and wider and wider. They're like super highways. So any extra gunk which I eat, any of the oil from the chips I ate this morning, it can pass through very easily because my blood vessels are so wide. You never get cardiac problems or strokes because it's easy to pass through. And that explains one of the things I was always interested in. Why are fat people always jolly and happy? It's true. Look at fat people. They're always happy and jolly. You know, one of my icons, because I was always interested in religion, as a young man, the sort of person I started to emulate in religion was a person called Friar Tuck from Robin Hood. You remember him? Friar Tuck? This really fat guy who was always into eating, but he was always so kind and wise and always happy. And of course the other fat guy I admire, you know, who's always laughing, is Santa Claus. Santa Claus, he's been alive for hundreds of years. And he's fat and he always goes ho ho ho. That's why he doesn't die. So, as long as, it doesn't matter if you're fat, as long as you laugh a lot and are very happy, you're going to survive. But if you're fat and miserable, you're going to die, which is why you don't see fat and miserable people anymore. They died a long time ago. They've been deleted in the evolutionary chain. So as long as I keep laughing, I can be a bit overweight. Same with you. So if you are overweight, anybody, and you don't want to go on a diet, the alternative is laughing. You laugh a lot and you'll be okay. But it's also, I'm aware enough, I can actually feel my body and I know sort of, you know, when it's tired, when it's sick. You can only do that in silence, not in fear, just feel when your body needs a rest. And then you give it a rest. You can feel when you've got energy, and then you're fine. Because a lot of times, people actually, another piece of science they told me, that heart attacks, they never come out of the blue. Some people think, they're walking, and they say, without any signal at all, they have this major cardiac problem, and the next thing they know, they're in hospital, you know, waiting for some bypass or stent or something. I remember this item saying, it never comes out of the blue. It gives you many warnings, first of all. Many warnings, but people are so insensitive. They're so busy thinking about something, they never feel their body. And they never notice sort of the warning signs, which come many times before the big one comes. It's insensitivity. So busy thinking about things, not enough silence to resist these things. That's why a lot of times people are in ill health, because they're out of touch with their body. In their head thinking, never feeling their body. Which is why sometimes, I know that sometimes people try and meditate, they just can't meditate because they think, think, think. Often I send them out into the bush, shoes off, if it's raining, no umbrellas, go and get wet. Go and get your feet pricked by the thorny bushes or something. Feel, for goodness sake. Now, get your whole hair totally wet and your clothes drenched. Feel it. Australia's not that cold, you're not going to get a flu or anything. But you really want to get in touch with your physical sensations and feelings. Go and just feel the wind. Don't think about it. Just feel it. Start to be, rather than always be thinking. And that is a wonderful example for people, because when they are listening to the sound of the birds, when they're feeling the rain just wet their body totally over, you're actually coming into a silent place. You're last alive in your physical sensations rather than always planning and thinking and remembering things. And that is powerful. It gets people in touch again. Or, the other example I do for silence, and I want you to contribute to this now, because as I am speaking, I also want every one of you to know what's going on in your head, to notice the reaction or what's occurring as I am speaking. Because as I am speaking, you will begin to notice some pauses between my words. In those spaces, what was happening inside your head? There it was again. You were silent. How wonderful that feels. There it is again. There's something sacred. Doesn't matter what religion you are. Something healing. Something very profound. In those spaces between the words. That little trick works. Because you never know when I'm going to start speaking again. You're actually waiting in the moment, rather than what I call waiting in the future. So many of us wait in the future, waiting for something to happen. And instead, we never know what's happening right now. Waiting in the moment, being here, rather than being off, expecting something in the future. In the waiting in the moment, you experience silence. And that silence is where all the peace, the happiness, and the wisdom comes from. The silent, still lake in the mountains. When there's not a thought going over the surface of the lake called your mind. When it's perfectly still. Only then does it reflect perfectly the beauty and the truth of the moon and the stars above the lake. One little ripple in the lake, one thought in the mind, distorts the truth. So in the silence, you feel the stillness. And there you can know truth, beauty. The last little anecdote before I open up for questions. There's an anecdote from the Taoist tradition. It was the best anecdote which I had. Maybe I've got another one coming afterwards. Is this fellow Lao Tzu, who was one of the founders of the Taoist tradition. He had a monastery in China. He had disciples. And every evening he would go on a walk through the mountains, through the forest. And one disciple, one follower could accompany him. But there was a golden rule. The attendant had to be silent. They were not allowed to speak. And as they were walking through the forest, they came to a ridge in the mountains, just at the time of sunset, at which point the disciple, forgetting the rule, blurted out, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." And at that, the master turned around, went back to the monastery. When he got back, he told all the other students, that student is never ever allowed to go on a walk with me again. He's banned for life. Because he broke the rule he spoke to in the walk. When the other student said, "Oh, give him a break. They only one mistake. He's young. Don't ban him for life, for goodness sake. And anyway, what is wrong with saying what's a beautiful sunset?" And at that, the master explained why silence is always closer to the truth than thoughts. The master said, "When my disciple said what a beautiful sunset, he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the thoughts, the words. He wasn't watching the sunset." And if you understand the meaning of that, you understand the difference between thinking and reality. Thinking are the words. The reality is only experienced in silence. And to reinforce that, my last little anecdote, which I probably said last year. That's why I only come once a year. Hopefully, in those 12 months, you forgot that I told the story last time. And that was the story of the professor of philosophy at Monash University. He was a professor of philosophy, but he also liked fine food. And when he heard that a new restaurant had opened up in the city of Melbourne, a 5-star chef was cooking for this restaurant, he picked up a telephone and made a reservation. Apparently it was such a popular restaurant that the professor had to wait almost 2 months to make a reservation. It was that full. When the time came for him to go to the restaurant, he dressed in a very sharp suit. He went to the restaurant and he had to check in with the maitre d', who asked for his ID. And when he checked the ID, he said, "Sir, yes, you have a reservation tonight." And he led him to his table. And being a very, very expensive restaurant, and the table was mahogany, all of the fittings were so plush, all of the interior decor was so expensive, like you'd expect to see in a palace. And the waiter came, dressed in tails like an English butler, and gave him the menu, which was printed on thick parchment, not like you get at McDonald's, thick parchment, black calligraphy with a gold border. Even the menu just matched the beauty and the fineness of that restaurant. And once the professor had received the professor ate the menu, paid his bill and left. Because the professor did not know the difference between the menu and the food. That's a problem. People who think too much, they only know menus. And the menu is very different from the food. So thinking what a beautiful sunset is so different from experiencing. Just like the menu is always different from the food. So if you want to be back in life, if you want to have wisdom, happiness, peace, freedom, try to develop a little bit more silence in your mind. When someone is talking to you, be silent, and then you'll be able to be communicated with. Then you'll know you learn so much. When your girlfriend is talking to you, not just be quiet with this, be quiet inside. Don't go thinking, "Here she goes again, how many times do I have to listen to this, Don't do that. The same when your boyfriend is talking to you. Listen with everything you've got. Silence. I call that total listening. In business, information is success in business. Listen with everything you've got. You pick up things others don't. Then you'll be highly successful in your life. Just like I have been successful in my life as a monk. I'm cultivating total listening, silence, being able to respond in totally unique ways, simply because from silence you become wise. Thank you. Sorry for your time.